I'm David Suchet, and this is Blood Ties.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall, and I'm here with my father, Jeffrey Wonsall.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you again for listening. We really appreciate it. We really appreciate the letters and the messages. It makes us very happy indeed.
It does. And this is a super exciting week because we've got our friend David Suchet here with us to do the podcast.
Hello, and I'm delighted to be with you all.
And did you have a good week?
I had the most amazing week, thank you, Jeffrey. I spent 4 days in the Camargue with professional photographers taking photographs of wildlife, of the most wonderful white horses. And black stallions, yes. And birds, in order to promote the Daily Mail Wildlife Photographic Competition, which will take place later this year. But I was completely out of my box. I have never taken photographs of wildlife before, and I had a ball.
Wonderful. We should say that David's got a new book out called David Suchet, My Life Behind the Lens, which I shall be referring to at some point during this podcast. Yeah. What about you, Mold? Did you have a good week?
I had a good week. It's just frantic. It was my birthday.
Yes, Molly had
it. It was my birthday on Saturday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Very successful birthday.
So that was nice. And that was it. That was all my big news.
Yeah. Well, I've had it seems relentless week. I don't know. Just endless things going on.
And we're prepping for our live podcast as well.
Oh, crikey. Anyway, the subject
this week
is
the real Poirot, which is why we've got David with us.
Because we have a real Poirot with us.
We've got the real Poirot here.
Now, let's begin at the beginning. There never was a prototype of Hercule Poirot. In other words, a real character upon whom Dame Agatha Christie based her creation. The closest, I suppose, was Sherlock Holmes, who, of course, was also fictional.
Yes, well, obviously, I'm speaking on behalf of Poirot at the moment.
Yes.
And Poirot didn't like Sherlock Holmes because he was fictional.
Yes, whereas Poirot never thought he was.
How
could he be?
Well, he's not.
Well, I did a little research. I mean, obviously, we all know that he first appeared in Dame Agatha's first book, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, in 1920, which he'd been writing since during the First World War. And finally, he disappeared in the last published story, Curtain, in 1975, an extraordinary span, 55 years. And David, you played every single Poirot story?
Yes.
Did you do every single one?
Yes, every single one. I think one of them was a merging of two brought into one episode. But if you allow for that and those two being there, I did. I can't believe that
it's,
I did.
It's
so
extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
You didn't do Black Coffee, that one play in which he appeared.
But I did.
Did you?
Yeah. You see, this is the extraordinary thing. When I look back over my time as Poirot, and I'll tell you how that came to be, Chichester Festival Theatre, with whom I have a very close relationship, were fundraising for their refurbishment. And I thought, do you know what? The only piece of work by Agatha Christie, Hercule Poirot, that I've never done is Black Coffee. So why don't I do Black Coffee at the Chichester Festival Theatre and set it up like a radio play? And that's what we did.
I remember now.
Do you now?
I remember.
And we went to Chichester Festival Theatre. I got my makeup people. What they didn't know was the audience were expecting a radio play, so they're expecting all of us actors to be in civvies. And Poirot makes a late entrance in Black Coffee. What they didn't know and what the audience didn't know was that I stayed in my dressing room. I had got my Poirot costume, padding, and my makeup artist with me, which they did not know. They came in secretly. I got dressed as Poirot completely. And on my entrance as Poirot into this so-called radio show, I walked in as him.
Marvellous.
And it was a wonderful moment. Fun. Absolutely wonderful. So, yes, I've even done Black Coffee.
Yes, even Black Coffee. Well, I just look back. Some people suggest that the name Hercule Poirot. I think she originally thought of it being Hercules with an S.
Yes.
I think. But she took part of it, Hercule, from a woman called Marie Belloc-Lowndes, Hercule Popo.
Oh.
And the other part from a man called Frank Howard Evans, who had a Monsieur Poiret at about the time she was considering it. And the most interesting parallel, I think, is he bears something of a resemblance to Inspector Hanard of the Sûreté in a novel by A.E.W. Mason called At the Villa Rose in 1910.
There are
little parallels out there.
I wonder how much truth there is in the fact of the Belgian refugees coming to Torquay, and she saw all of those. And there's a wonderful photograph. Everybody looks like Poirot. They've all got these wartime moustaches.
I think that's a great deal to do with it. And I think the fact, for example, when he first appears in Styles, and when you first appear in shooting The Mysterious Affair at Styles, it's a Belgian refugee group,
it is.
And you're leading it with a slight limp?
Very slight limp. The producer didn't want me to have the limp I wanted to have.
Yeah.
Because Hercule Poirot describes himself as having a limp. He actually says in a letter, which we'll get to later, that he had a limp. And I wanted to do that, but the producer didn't want me to do that because he thought if it was a very severe limp, I'd be stuck with that for every other story,
yes.
And he didn't want that.
But didn't you later, towards the end, say, oh, I might have had a war wound or something?
Exactly yes. So that was incorporated.
That was incorporated.
Yes.
But that sense of this little Belgian who, I mean, she obviously thought he was old in 1920 when she wrote the story.
Well, he was, because he had already retired from the Belgian police force, and he was senior, he was head of the detective department in the Belgian police force, and he had retired. And by 1936, when he wrote this letter to a Monsieur Dodd, he says, I have completely retired, but I have found myself in the vogue. Everybody wants me, so
yes.
How can I keep working? But he starts as slightly to the elderly part of middle age. He has retired. So he should be in his 60s in Mysterious Affair at Styles.
Yes.
And if that's the case, he should be well over 100 by
the time he finishes. There's no question of that, David.
Because Agatha Christie never intended to write that many stories.
No.
She thought, I'd do this and then I'll move on to other things.
No.
And
this extraordinary character...
Exploded.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, by the time it gets to 1930, only 10 years after, she calls him insufferable.
Yeah.
And yet she keeps on writing.
Well, it's very fashionable for a writer to bite the hand that feeds them.
Well, let's come on to that letter, because it's very helpful. When you started out to play Poirot, you did two things. One of them, I was actually there when you started, was to write down all his characteristics. And you actually have with you your original.
I have my... Funnily enough, I was looking in my cupboard and I know I took to the set photocopies of my 93 character notes in order to remind myself, because I wanted to stay absolutely in the character that Agatha Christie wrote. And I found my original copy, and there it is in pen.
Oh, my God, that is amazing.
I know, and I've got it now, and I've got... well, let me see. Go to the end of them. And
a lot of pages of notes.
There we are. 93.
Yes.
Will wipe dirty seats and benches with his handkerchief before sitting down. Similarly, when kneeling on the floor. And then I've made a note. Then, of course, there is the definitive self-description in his letter to Monsieur Dodd, in which there are many, many of his self-confessed characteristics. And I have that letter with me here.
Yes. So let's. When you started, and we've had this conversation once before, you wanted to be true to the writer. You wanted to create not exactly what Agatha Christie had imagined.
Let me go back a bit and just talk about my ethos as an actor. There was a time when I was developing as an actor and maturing that I got very fed up with just being me and worried about how good I was and press and all that sort of thing. And I decided to investigate what I was doing as a person. What am I? What is my purpose in life? Is this all it is? Is this going to be self, 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 self? Because I'm not very happy doing that. cutting a very long story short, I realised that there were writers, there are millions of writers throughout history, who have written to be performed and not to write the novel. And if you write to be performed, you have to give your work away to people like me to interpret and create the characters, if you're an actor, that they have written. So I found myself wanting and needing to serve my writer.
Yep.
That's as succinct as I can be. Yep. So cut to Poirot.
Yes.
When I started reading the books, I saw a character that I'd never seen portrayed before.
Yeah.
I saw this little man as Agatha Christie wrote him, and I thought, yes, I have my mission. My mission is to be the real Poirot that Agatha Christie wrote for the billions of her readership,
yeah,
so that they could read it and see her Poirot, because her Poirot is the real Poirot.
Yes, and that, we all know, is exactly what you did with enormous success. I mean, she's been translated into 103, 105 languages. She's the biggest-selling writer after Shakespeare and the Bible. It is an extraordinary canon of work, of which you have translated it to the screen in a way that I doubt anyone can ever forget. It is literally a definitive performance. Other people may come and bring their own, and you've talked about that, but it is, and that's why you are, for us, for Molly and I, the real Hercule.
I loved it so much when I was growing up. I had the audiobooks, I had watched every single episode. I was literally...
And what's your youngest memory of watching? How old were you when you sat down to watch?
I don't know. I mean, I got into, pretty young, probably like 10, maybe, yes, or even younger.
Well,
possibly.
The first show started, David?
1989. It was shown on television.
I was born in 83.
Yeah, you were 6.
Well, there you were 6. And cut now to 31 years later, from 1989 to now, what's that?
That's
30. 30 years, about a month ago, I remember telling you this, Geoffrey, I received a photograph from actually my former trainer at a gym. We became very friendly. He moved to Australia and he sent me a photograph of his 4-year-old sitting in front of a television watching me as Poirot in Australia.
It's timeless, timeless.
It is timeless. And it's also, and we talked about this a little, there's something about it gives people comfort.
I agree with that.
Particularly lonely people.
Very much so. My mailbag is full of lonely singles who sit with Poirot. And there's the famous letter I got that I talk about with great affection of a very, very elderly lady who puts one end of her table against the television and has dinner with me.
Oh, goodness.
Yes.
But it's true because you're recurring, because you keep coming back, because you're so familiar, you feel like you're with you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, people feel safe. And yeah. I think he's a great moral compass.
Yes.
People feel very protected in his company. And he's kind.
Yes.
And I think that's why they like him. He's very kind. He's very gentle. He can be insufferably angry and irritable when it suits him, and when he gets to the English upper classes and all that. But generally, to people downstairs and upstairs, generally, he's very, very kind. He respects, in his own words, I respect every human being's dignity.
Yes, and one of the things too that I think conveys itself is that to some extent he was quite lonely himself, wasn't he?
Well, and this is actually, if I brought out something that I think Agatha Christie intended but didn't dwell on, I brought out more his loneliness, because he actually says, I've got in one of my notes here, that the relationship between a man and a wife, two a male and a female joined together in marriage, is one of God's greatest gifts. Mm. Who's saying that? A man who is not married.
No.
So therefore, my interpretation, whenever Poirot saw happy couples together, I made him become slightly wistful with a sense of, this is what I don't have.
Yes. Mm. And I think that conveys itself. It is extraordinary. At one point, 750 million people around the world were watching you playing Hercule Poirot. Mm-hmm. It's an astonishing figure. And they were picking up something which hasn't gone away. It's still with us now.
I know.
You know, watching the early shows, the late shows, It has never, ever gone away.
Am I allowed to ask, like, fangirly question, like, which is your favourite episode?
Well,
do you not have one?
No, I
your
do. Well, I have a favourite story.
Your favourite story.
My favourite story happens to be ABC Murders, the one that they did recently on television. I think it's a brilliant book. I think it really does sum up Agatha Christie's incredible tangential mind. I mean, her plot in that
it's
story
so clever.
Is quite extraordinary.
You don't get, like, I never could. I can never guess who it is either.
No.
Well, it's one of the interesting things about there is an arc in the stories, David, isn't there? That he starts off being rather more clue-driven. And then gradually, as he develops, he becomes more psychological insight.
Well, the facts, Hastings, the
yes.
facts. Motivation, Hastings, motivation. Yes. Order and method. All I need, he says, all I need are my little grey cells. And those grey cells, although they've become a sort of jokey, you know, the grey cells of Hercule Poirot, that is him. Agatha Christie describes him as a walking brain. He will sit there, he will close his eyes, and he will go in order and method through the facts.
Yes.
And that's how he solves the cases. He doesn't need evidence. He doesn't need forensics. He doesn't need any of that. It's all in his mind.
And he's a great one for encouraging people to talk to him, whether they're the servant or the...
Well, he is, as he says, I am the world's greatest listener. And his famous comment to a lady who... She was talking and talking and she said, I'm so sorry, I'm talking too much. She said, Madame, for Hercule Poirot, I listen to what you say, but I hear what you mean.
It is a wonderful remark.
And there is the greatest listener who stays silent yes. while somebody else is talking and does not work out what he's going to say next. He listens until that person has finished.
Yes.
He's brilliant.
So let's go back to his character and go back to his letter, the
yes.
letter written in 1936 to
Monsieur Dodd. And actually, this is Agatha Christie having a bit of fun with Hercule Poirot because Dodd was part of the publishers who published her books, Dodd Mead
yes.
and Company. And he was writing a letter to Monsieur Dodd, although it's not obvious in the letter. But yeah, here it is.
So let's
well,
let's have an
published
extract.
By Dodd Mead and Company in 1936, a letter to dear Monsieur Dodd. And well, he introduces himself, and then in the second paragraph he says, "So you think the Americans will be interested in reading about Hercule Poirot? I, who undoubtedly have the finest brain in Europe, do you not know that above all things I have a horror of publicity? But it is well that you sent me in your letter a list of questions, and these I am answering in the same order. And if it were not for the mal de mer and the difficulty of practicing the so excellent method of la verguille for a long time than a few hours of crossing the channel, I should be delighted to voyage myself on one of these big liners to see you." And in this letter, he then continues. He starts with his first case, and then he describes how he works. We've talked about limping, and he said, "I limped badly in those days. And behind that lies a story which Captain Hastings has not yet told you." So it was a war wound. In 1923, I set up as a private detective in London, sharing joint rooms with mon ami Hastings. And then he talks about George, his valet. And then he talks about himself. Order and method, he says, are my gods. So they're not just things I use. Order and method are my gods. For my breakfast, I have only toast, which is cut into tiny little squares, and the eggs, there must be two, they must be identical in size. So this is a gold mine, this letter of
yes.
information, and it was for me as the actor, because in here, in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pages, and he actually apologises for it being a long letter, in 7-page letter, he has told me, the actor, almost everything I need to know in general terms about this little man, who does not, by the way, consider himself little.
No.
He says, I am not little. People call me little. He says, I am not little. I am 5 foot four.
Yes. But it would be fair to say, wouldn't it, that Agatha herself, you know, by 1960, described him, as if I'm correct, as detestable, bombastic, tiresome, egocentric little creep.
Oh, that's so unfair.
Yes. I don't think that...
She really meant it.
Well, I don't think that a lot of people today would agree with her either.
I agree with her. I don't agree with her, but I'm really saying...
But I can see from an author's point of view, because he became so successful. And don't forget, you'll know this but more than me. When did she actually write Curtain?
Oh, long before it was published. About 1960, she was obviously tired of him.
And who didn't allow her to publish? Her publishers said, I'm not going to publish it.
Oh, God, you wouldn't kill her. No way.
So absolutely. She was forced, in a way,
to continue
writing.
Yeah.
No wonder she got fed up with him.
Yeah.
And that was why I believe she spoke about him like he did. I'm fed up with him. I don't want to. He's irritating. I don't like being with him, and I don't like this.
But in fact, you're absolutely right. The publisher said no, no. And it's also true that the audience, as Molly says, certainly wouldn't have agreed with her.
No way.
I mean, the books were incredibly successful.
They were unbelievably successful. Then there was a description, I believe, of one person holding a Poirot book on the bus. They were reading on the omnibus, but so that nobody else could look over them to see what they were reading. They wouldn't give the plot away.
No. No, people are very protective.
They are very protective.
Do you think when they came out, it was like, have you read the new Poirot?
Absolutely.
Like Harry Potter.
The water cooler conversation.
Yeah, this is the new TV. This is the new TV series. Have you read the latest Poirot?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure that was
the
case.
Yes, I think that's right, Molly.
Yeah.
So
it would have been good. Good fun.
You played him for 25 years with a gap. When ITV decided perhaps that we weren't going to go on, and then they changed their minds. It's an extraordinarily long period of time to spend with one character. Mm. I mean, wonderfully, you did other work. I mean, a lot of theatre as well. It wasn't just Poirot on television. But how did you... In your new book, you talk about him as your alter ego, and when you stopped playing him, you started to grieve.
Well,
do you still?
Yes, I do. I grieve in the sense that I've got over the initial grief, of course, but I miss him. I miss him as a friend. And the reason for that is that the way I work is I don't paint on a character. I've never been very good at that. And it's not because I've chosen to do this. It's the way I am because of I said, my ethos that I wish to serve my writer. If I'm going to serve my writer, I want to become... In all aspects, the character, the person that they write about. And that's what I do. So that if I take on a character like Poirot, and it's not just a question of painting on, or wearing a false moustache, wearing padding, and then putting on a French accent and trying to be funny. No, I will become that person. And if I become that person, I will sympathise and empathise with every single thing they do. I will get to know them. I take my characters, even when I'm studying in a play, I'll take my characters out into the street to see how they might react. And so I get to know them even more. And I reject certain things and I accept certain things. But the way Agatha Christie writes, and with my notes, the 93 notes that I made, having read every single novel before I started filming, and then getting hold of this wonderful letter, I was able to become Poirot almost in entirety by the time we began. And then I played him for 25 years. So you get to know a person... You get to know their worldview, you get to know what they feel about religion, you get to know what they feel about family, what they like, what they dislike, what they eat, where they would go, where he went to be shaved, who looks after his moustache, etc., etc. So that I could, very early on, I could put on his spectacles, if you like, symbolically, and move through a day with his worldview, and I would know every single moment of every single day how... I or Poirot would behave. So he became, for me, my alter ego.
But there were instances, weren't there, particularly even early on in the filming, when I'm thinking of the handkerchief incident, when you were going to sit on a bench and you did exactly what you believed Poirot would have done. You cleaned the bench with your handkerchief. And the director said, no, I don't want you to do that.
The interesting thing about that, and it was a big argument on the set, was that Agatha Christie has Poirot doing it in her book.
Mm.
So it wasn't something that David Suchet wanted to do. It was something that she had him doing on every single bench he sat on.
Yes.
And in that story, he did. So all I was doing was defending my character.
You were defending the real Hercule Poirot.
The real Hercule Poirot. Yes. And there was a director saying, oh, I don't want you to do that. Well, excuse me. If you want me to play Poirot and you want me to be the real Poirot, then I've got to do what Agatha Christie tells me to do because she created me, not you.
Yes,
you did not.
But the delightful payoff is that you were never seen sitting on the bench. And the wiping was left on the cutting room floor. That was the end of it.
But I was able to do it, thankfully, in many other episodes. Yeah. And it became a sort of feature of him. Yeah. And it's the same thing. He would always put his handkerchief down before he knelt on the grass. He doesn't like grass. He doesn't like coming out. He only likes pavements anyway, and he's very great. He doesn't like the countryside. He's very grateful to artists who paint the countryside so that he doesn't have to visit visit himself, so that he can enjoy that he has paintings in his room full of countryside scenes, and he says, I will visit here this morning after breakfast and have a lovely time in the country. So he's a wonderful eccentric. But back to your point, yes, if you know someone that well and you live with them for that long,
yes,
and then you have to die,
yes,
you have to play that man's death.
Yes.
Well, if you are that person, part of you dies with him.
Absolutely.
And therefore, I don't think it's an actor-lovey thing. I think it's just the way I work. I love that character, and he became my best friend. And on the day of shooting,
I remember, I was there.
You were there. My wife was there. You remember the crew.
Yes, I do.
They were all in tears.
Absolutely. The sound man was weeping.
Was weeping as I was dying. I finished that, and I remember going back to my trailer, sitting down, having died as Poirot, and not knowing quite what to do or how to think or what to do. And I know that I had to play another scene afterwards, because we don't do things sequentially. Afterwards. And then after that series, and I will just take a moment here to explain, after that episode, a curtain had been completed, I insisted that that should not be the end of my filming. And we did another episode after that so that I could leave Poirot still living.
Yes.
However, at the end of the contract, I knew that was the end of my Poirot, that I'd been my friend for 25 years. And yes, there was an immense grief. Now I miss him.
Well, that's very nice to hear.
Do you, like, carry him with you? You know, when something happens in the world, do you think of what his response to it would be?
I can't help it because, yeah, you know what, Molly? He's on every week.
He's now on BritBox every week as well.
Yeah, I mean, people are still watching him. So when they see me in the street, they still think I'm playing him.
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
The two people who were running this photographic course in the Camargue the other day, when I got off the plane and they met me, she nearly fainted because she cannot believe that she was watching me the night before.
it is a very odd feeling.
It's an odd... Well, I don't know what that's like, but she couldn't speak to me. She could not speak to me because, A, she's been watching for over...
Every year, 30 forever, years.
But she's watching the repeats in the Camargue.
Yes.
Yeah.
Repeats are everywhere.
So Poirot Suchet lives on as still playing them in his mind. In Russia, it's on.
Yes.
And I know where it's on because of my mailbag.
Yes.
I get stuff from Japan. I get stuff then from China. I get stuff from...
I can't think there can be very many other examples of an actor inhabiting a role for so long. It's more than... I know Raymond Burr in Perry Mason. It's longer than Law and Order, it's longer than
John
Thor.
I can't think of anything else as long.
Nothing.
But wasn't I lucky, Jeffrey, that I was a character actor and they gave me other work?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But I never got... Look, the world will remember me as Poirot. The obit will be huge on Poirot. But my career has been diverse.
No, absolutely. And you've done a lot of theatre work, still do a lot of theatre work, just under price.
Yeah.
You do a lot of other things, but it is that kind of real Poirot which makes it so fascinating to talk to you about it, because it is bringing to life someone who's cherished and whom you've cherished.
Oh, I have cherished. I'm not going to be Agatha Christie and bite the hand that
no,
feeds me.
No, you cherish him.
Oh, I cherish him. He did... Look, I can go into a room. If I put his glasses on now, he'll drive me crazy because that picture over there has to be straightened. And I would then, oh, my goodness, Jeffrey, your tie is not quite straight. I'd have to straighten it. And Molly, your necklace is not quite... The little medallion, it's not in the middle, and it would drive me crazy. Yeah, he is irritating if I put on his glasses. But you know what? I love him.
Yes.
Can I ask, as an agent now, what the process was for you to get the part? Like, how lengthy was the process? Were you up against other people at the time? Like, what was the... How did it happen that they just...
All I know is that I got a telephone call from Brian Eastman, who was a producer for the BBC when I was doing Blot on the Landscape. So I got to know Brian quite well. He rang me. I was living in Acton at the time and said he'd like to take me out for an Indian meal. He wants to discuss something with me. So we went to an Indian meal in Acton. He talked to me about the fact that ITV and the Agatha Christie Estate want to do 10 short stories of Hercule Poirot. And I had been chosen as number one actor.
Oh, okay.
And would I consider it? Do I know Poirot, etc., etc., etc.? So that's how it began.
Okay.
Later on, I discovered, when I became very friendly with Rosalind and Anthony Hicks and Matthew Pritchard, the grandson of Agatha Christie, Rosalind Hicks, her daughter, Anthony Hicks, Rosalind's husband, her daughter actually said to me that I was their first choice with ITV. And because they had seen me as Blot on the Landscape, and also, actually, I have to say, they saw the most terrible performance I gave as Inspector Japp in 13 at Dinner with the wonderful Peter Ustinov. Yeah. But I was so bad that they couldn't put one character to the other. And anyway, they wanted me to do it because they knew that I could do character work. And that's how I came to be cast.
The dream. I mean, as an agent, that's an absolute dream to have. Someone just decide you're the perfect person for a part.
Because you don't have to fight for
it. I don't have to, yeah. Well, you've done it already by the work you've done previously. But no, I mean, there's nothing we like more than getting a call saying we'd really like your client to play this role. They'd be perfect.
But I think where I was lucky is that I was... Well, if it was shown in 1989, I was filming at the end of 1988. So I was 42. I became professional at the age of 23 in 1969. So I had already done a whole...
This is what I constantly tell my actors, which is like when they graduate from drama school and they're like, I'm ready. Where's my fame? And I'm like, okay, it's going to take like 10 years until you start working solidly, at least. And then however long it will take until...
Well, it's like Joel Grey's famous remark about Cabaret and winning the Oscar. I'm an overnight success after 13 years.
Oh, wonderful. But it's so true, isn't it? It's so true.
Yeah.
And also, if that's all you want as a young actor, fame, you know...
Well, you know, not that, but the work, they actually need to be constantly working.
Well, it's a wonderful scene in the Kominsky Method with Michael Douglas addressing these audience and says, well, perhaps I should tell you about the business of being an actor. You're not going to get any work. Get used to that.
Yeah.
There's no work.
And actually, I say that in my book.
You do.
Unemployment actually is part of your career.
Yes, that's what I say to my clients all the time. Anybody can handle being in work. Being out of work
that's
is the
tougher.
Hard part. Dealing with that, going through that relationship with your agent, going through that part, handling that in your life, the rest, if you can do that,
but
you can
you know what?
Those.
If any actor is listening to this, can I give you that actor who is now out of work and very frustrated and depressed and constantly ringing your agent to say what's going on? Can I tell you that the gap that you have now between your last job and your next job, which your agent is working for, you have the opportunity to keep your instrument tuned in really good state. You have a time to really study the newspapers and be up with what's happening in your country. You've got time to visit art galleries and listen to music on the radio. You've got time to develop yourself as a human being, by which time, when you are offered a role, you are ready and even better than you were before.
I couldn't agree more, but I think one of the things that young actors, particularly they're in drama school, they're just out, think, and it's again, I refer to the Kosminski method, one of the girls, Douglas, is saying, look, sorry, and she puts her hand up and says, do you think I should get a vocal coach? And he says, have you listened to a single word I've said?
Yeah.
No, but I think my voice is a little high, don't you? I want it to be more chesty. And another girl, and this is not a misogynist point, what do you mean I'm not going to work? Look at this face. How can I not work?
Jeffrey's a big fan of the Kosminski method. I don't know if you've watched it yet.
I know I haven't, but I will now.
You should. It's very good.
It's very, very good. Yeah. Because it's also about that becoming the character, inhabiting the character.
Yes.
There's a marvellous moment, and it's absolutely appropriate when a girl stands up, so I'm going to do the monologue from X, and she does it. And Douglas goes up to her and says, yeah, that's what Sally Field did. Now can we have your
lovely.
Your monologue.
Yeah.
Tell the audience, tell us all your... And it is about that. It's about inhabiting the role, which is why this is such an extraordinary conversation, because the real Hercule Poirot is absolutely at the heart of everything we're talking about.
Exactly.
But by the way, just to add, I never knew I would do any more than 10 short stories. That was my contract.
Yeah, sure.
And I was never, over the 25 years, which comes as a terrific shock to people, I was never contracted on anything longer than one series.
The run of the series.
Yeah. The run of the... However many
but
I was going to make that...
You.
They never even optioned me.
Oh, my word. Mm. That wouldn't happen now.
No, but if you look back, I have signed a 25-year contract? No way.
But
no,
none of the
that would have been the end of the career.
Sign on to shows like Game of Thrones when it started, or any of those shows, they all will have had to sign up to 7-year options.
Yep. No.
And obviously you find that hard, being like, am I really committing to this for 6 months of my life?
Which gives me a problem now as an actor, because if somebody offered me that now, I would have to say no at my age anyway. Because I don't know if I'm going to live that long, but I would have no other life.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
Where is the life?
But Poirot gave me another reason for missing him and being grateful for him and to him. Is that he and the success of the series gave me, proverbially, forgive me using the word on air, but made me what we call bums on seats actor. In other words, people would cast me in a theatre play because they knew that I would attract an audience mm-hmm. and get them on the seats.
Yeah.
So without this huge success, I would not have had the varied career that I've had, although being well known for playing Poirot more than anybody else.
But you've said in your new book, Behind the Lens, you talk about, well, you've had some very interesting work offers since. You've done some very interesting television press, Decline and Fall. Mm. You did The Price in the West End recently. You know, it hasn't curtailed your career.
It hasn't stereotyped you into just that, has it?
I really do. I'm not just saying this. I really do count myself so fortunate. I really do. And, you know, this is because of him.
Yes.
The real Poirot. This is because I chose to play him as Agatha Christie wrote him. And that was by chance. That's just my ethos of being an actor. I think if I'd have gone out on a limb and done something completely either comical or something like that that would make everybody I don't think I would have lasted. I think her readership has kept me alive.
I agree. Mm. Wholeheartedly.
Oh, that was great.
Well, now
thank
we can...
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Is thank you
over?
So much for coming.
Great. So nice.
But, you know, you're going to have a great week. Well, I'm. What am I doing next? So many things next
so
week.
So many things. We're so grateful for you coming. It's really important to us on the podcast. Obviously, normally we talk about a real murder every week.
Yes.
But we also really are so fascinating, because like, the sort of inception of the podcast, and it comes from like just a real love of true crime, and my my love of true crime stems from fictional crime. Like, that's the thing that really interests me, like whether it's Poirot or Miss Marple or Sherlock Holmes or whoever. Like, I love Charles Paris, like whoever it is, like, I'm down. So it's really important to us to cover this line between fact and fiction and really talk about also the detectives and criminals that are a huge part of our fascination.
And it's true of everything that we watch. I mean, if you look at Mindhunters on Netflix, which is about real criminals, except it's fictionalized, if you like, it's an incredibly important part of people's lives. People are fascinated.
We love crime.
Isn't it lovely that Hercule Poirot doesn't like Sherlock Holmes because it's fiction?
Yes, I think that's delightful.
I think that is such a coup for a writer who's creating this character to believe that he actually exists.
Well,
I love it.
It's tremendous.
Isn't it?
Well, thank you, dear. That's absolutely delightful.
Well, it was such a pleasure. Lovely to be with you, Molly, and to see you again. And Geoffrey, as always, my dear friend.
But, well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. We have very much. As I say at the end of every episode, bad things happen to good people, so do be careful out there.